WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Yes, welcome to another Monday Night Talk. This, of course, your Independence Day edition. It is July 3rd. We thank you for keeping us on in the background. Maybe you're moving from one 4th of July party to another. You have us on in the background. You're listening. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Kevin Tachi, and I'll be here for until 8 o'clock. And we have a great show in store for you. Leading off for this program this evening, we'll start with State Representative Jim Cantwell, as he'll be joining us in a few moments with a couple of different topics. We'll talk a little bit about the commission that he is on, talk a little bit about cybersecurity, and where do things stand with the new recreational marijuana bill that they're looking to hopefully expand the tax base from the meager 12% and where that's going. There'll be another candidate from the great town of Weymouth. We have Chris Primiano will be my guest at 6:40. We'll chat with him about getting in this race, a candidate for counselor at large, and some of the issues going on in Weymouth. Second hour of Monday Night Talk, we will speak with Barbara Mataloni, president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. She'll be joining nearly 8,000 educators from every state as they come together to discuss some of the pressing issues that are facing students, schools, the teaching profession during the NEA 155th annual meeting and 96th representative assembly being held in Boston. We had her on last year, and there are some interesting topics that they're going to be looking to discuss this year. So we'll touch base with Barbara about that. And then, batting fourth, cleanup. We have one of today's most widely read and acclaimed authors. This is an individual with 500 million copies sold in 38 languages around the globe. Also touted as a New York Times number one best-selling author, we have Dean Koontz be joining us, and he's going to talk about his new suspense novel, The Silent Corner. Looking forward to speaking with him about this. And I will say, according to my information, this is a new series that already has been optioned for television. So that's kind of exciting. So we have quite the lineup for you this evening. Please keep that radio dial set. And before we step aside to check traffic, I will remind you that you too can be a part of the program in your own way, whether you send an email to mondaynighttalk@gmail.com. Look for the Monday Night Talk Facebook page. Easy enough to do. You'll actually find the page with my picture along with Joe Rossi's still attached with the Monday Night Talk logo. Or you can follow me on Twitter @KevinTachi or #MondayNightTalk. All right, we'll step aside right now and find out what's happening out on the roadways.
is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Back in the 1950s, Grossman's in Braintree had sitting out in front of their lot a gigantic pile of intertwined wire cable. Neighborhood kids told one another it was an anti-submarine net used during World War II. Maybe the one at Pearl Harbor. Kids used to climb all over it. Very dangerous. Bill Buckley even took home a clip from it. He left it on his front porch and then forgot all about it. That was the summer of 1958. 40 years later, Bill was mowing his parents' lawn, a favor he enjoyed. Suddenly, the mower blade struck that clip and sent it smashing through his own windshield. When he picked it up from the front seat, he had no clue.
I'm Tiny of Tiny and Sons Glass. We come to your work or home, and we fix your windshield. Your insurance covers it. We're Tiny and Sons. My boys do a good job. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right. Well, thank you for keeping us on in the background during your 4th of July holiday, even though it is only Monday, July 3rd. Batting leadoff on our program this evening, as I teased just a few moments ago, is none other than State Representative Jim Cantwell. As we are doing the State House report, it has become a staple on Monday Night Talk, the idea to let our local leaders, whether it's a state senator, state representative, governor, auditor, you name it, we try to get them in here. Maybe it's somebody who is a selectman or a city council, town council, mayor. We have them in as well. And we try to get an idea of what's going on, get an update. So, Representative, here we are, July 3rd. Any big plans for the next couple of days?
Yes, we're heading down just a little later tonight. Going to be heading down to Brant Rock to watch all the festivities. It's a couple for the Medlin family has a party down there, so we'll go and be right on Foster Ave and watch all of the fireworks, all of the fun, and take it in with lots of community.
Oh, see, I thought you were going to say you're going to be down having a bonfire down at Hummer Rock. Oh, wait, no, they can't do that, can they? I can say that jokingly because I still have family that lives down in Hummer Rock. The LaCroix, the Tachis still live down on Central Avenue, Central Street, that area down there. My grandmother used to have a house that was the beach. You could see
sure. The
beach in the backyard. And has since, I think it's been sold to another family member, but that was kind of a staple. 4th of July, we would go down as kids, and there'd be, you know, everybody would have setting off fireworks.
Sure.
You could look down the beach line and down the beach, and you could see everybody for
right. Miles. Absolutely. So, and you still do. You still see all the fireworks. You still see all the revelry. I do remember when I was...
But then you see cruises that are chasing those people. Go, put that fire out.
Well, it depends on how big. We do remember years ago when there was a high tide, and a bunch of folks still decided they wanted their bonfire, and they put it right up real close, and a couple of homes caught fire. So like everything, with a reasonableness, keeping things to be under control, we're going to have a great time. All of Marshall, all of Scituate gets down in the water this whole season, so we're looking forward to a great summer.
And I want to thank you for coming and being our first guest, stopping by before you enjoy your festivities this evening. But we want to give you an opportunity just to kind of catch folks up in the 4th Plymouth District as to some of the things that you're working on. One of the first things that when we were talking, you had mentioned that you're working on something regarding cybersecurity. And if that hasn't become more prevalent these days, more so on more globally, more right. Of a national level,
right.
Especially just last week, we saw there were attacks in Europe.
For the second time just in the last month, yes. Mm. And allegedly using things that our national security folks had been using, trying to promote. But there's no doubt that there has been a 40% increase in data breaches just from 2015 to 2016. Crime, it's now moving off the streets, and it's now on our cyber highways. It's a tremendous concern. Nationally, we've heard, or in the world, that is, the second highest economic crime in the world is cyber crime. That by two...
ransomware, stuff
yes,
like that?
Yes, yes. And we have even ransomware just in Massachusetts. Three different police departments, Tewksbury being one of them, had to pay because they had cyberware, took over their entire system. They had to
pay bitcoins.
Yes, and you can't trace them. If ever there's a need for a statewide or nationwide response when our local police can't trace where these criminals are attacking from, it's a real problem. Where it came to my attention, Kevin, is just a few months ago, I had a constituent call who was doing all the right things. She was online, wanted to, they had an anniversary coming up, wanted to get a property out in California that she was going to rent for a period of time. She had a relative who was out there, so they drove by to make sure this property existed. She was signing up, she thought, on Airbnb. She had an interaction. She actually called a phone number because the Airbnb that she thought was correct, where she was sending the money, there was a phone number she called. Everything seemed legit. Sent her $2,000 as a down payment. Got a reply back, and it just, at that point, something didn't seem right to her. So she then tried again to confirm and was saying, uh-oh, I think I'm being victimized. Called our local police. They said, you know, we're not able to help, but they took information. They told her to call the state police. She called there. This is all while it's happening. State police couldn't help. Called my office. I got in touch with Congressman Keating's office. We had the FBI on the line. My intern up at the State House was able to get online and was tracing back where this website came from. This person was not super sophisticated. They're in New Hampshire. So we're giving the information, but no one was able to at that moment help. And it struck me. I said, we need to have one-stop shopping in Massachusetts, probably out of the Attorney General's office, where we can have a cybercrime unit.
Task force and such?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So we filed legislation. Part of the legislation is going to have an expert body that will advise the legislature on security. It would be a commission of experts across the board. We've already been meeting with some incredibly brilliant people, Kevin. I'm really impressed at that the folks were calling in from the MITs of this world and the like. So we'll have that body. We're increased penalties right now for someone who is convicted of hacking into someone's computer or their system. Our maximum fine is $1,000. Maximum time in jail is 30 days. It's like a pittance to these people that do it for a living. And then we need to protect things in the future. The next wave, you and I, instead of passwords, we're going to use our fingerprints, thumbprints, our retina scans. So we need to protect those as well. So that's the legislation. We had several experts come and testify. The bill is House 3618. Two cybercrime experts, Dr. Kyung Choi, I think to pronounce correctly, who's a criminal justice professor at Bridgewater State. He's on a United Nations panel. He came. He's the one that's consulting with police departments. He is the one, the doctor, who talked of how we've had ransomware hit three of our Massachusetts police departments. And an attorney, Stephen Chow, who's a business leader and an attorney who represents business interests around the state, who talked about how we need new and passionate leadership at the state level, because he said the federal level has really, frankly, in the last couple of years, he said, has not been able to act on this. So everyone knows back, you know, people wanted to talk about all the election issues and the Russians who are apparently were into 19 of our databases across the country. It's just showing that we need a unified response, hopefully a national response, but we intend to do something about it here in the state.
So this is a bill, and this is right now, has this gone to committee yet?
It just had its hearing just now a little over a week ago. We're working hard to make sure, and as the committee chairman, Barbara Letalian, the chairperson, one of her police departments, Tewksbury, was one of the ones that had to do the ransomware. She's very much on board. What we agreed right there is that we'd be working with staff to try to go through and address. One of the interesting things in Massachusetts, the Mass Bankers Association has come out in favor of the bill, because one of our requirements is that we'd want people to share information. There is no incentive right now. If I represent Target and Target has a breach, we're the only state that doesn't allow the banks to say to people, the breach happened at X location. They're forbidden from doing that. And there's no incentive for people to share best practices or share what's taking place. We need to change that immediately. And the bankers say, we get blamed. People get angry at us. Every breach, they're telling us the average cost of a breach is about $7 million of an organizational breach. So at the very beginning, sharing information information, getting what you're doing right now. Thank you always to WATD for bringing attention to these issues, because, folks, we have to be so diligent at our homes. Luckily, since we do have, most of us, when you buy your operational systems, we have a somewhat of a higher level of protection than they are doing in Europe and in other countries. But we're still very much at risk, as the recent information about our election showed last year.
So the next time you stop by to give us an update, we'll have to make sure that we find out where things stand with that bill. Let's talk about something else. I believe you chair this commission, the Promote Prevent Commission. What's going on with that group?
This is a very exciting commission. We have 22 members, folks who've been meeting now for several months. I co-chair it with a Senator Flanagan, who's from the Worcester area, but our own Senator Pat O'Connor's on this commission with me. One thing that we've discovered, 97% of the money that we spend now when we're dealing with substance use disorders, 97% of the money is spent downstream, by which I mean to say it's someone who's already having a real problem. It could be someone having to have Narcan given, fire department shows up, could be they get rushed to the hospital, so it's recovery coaches, could be, heaven forbid, they have to go to jail, so paying money for jails or the police, or long-term recovery, long-term treatment. They're all important, and we do obviously want to fund those, and I'm proud of some of the budgets we've done to make sure we're helping people in the throes of addiction. But the problem is we only spend 3% trying to stop the problem in the first place. So this Promote Prevent Commission was created by legislation I wrote with Cheryl Bartlett, the former Commissioner of Public Health, not focusing, yes, on substance misuse, but it's all behavioral health issues. One of the statistics from testimony early on is that for mental health issues, we know 50% of people who will have mental health disorders, we know by age 13. And the issue is trying to make sure that we envelope folks who can have services earlier on, outpatient services, getting help, so they don't decompensate and have to go to an emergency room. For criminal behavior, I used to be an assistant DA years ago. You look at someone's record, they could have a 5-page record, and you look way back at the first time when they were 12 or 13 having a shoplifting. Great work. A member of our commission is the Chief Justice, Paula Carey, and she said work that they're doing early on, that if someone first has an interaction with the criminal justice system, how we can try to act then to try to prevent people from having a life of crime. Educators who are on the commission, who are saying, you know, we have proven programs that we start at second grade being done in other states, and they have 20 years of data showing of the benefits of having communities that care is one program, mm-hmm. a good behavior game is another program, these different things. The state of Ohio did a bond for 2/3 of their schools are paying through a bond to have these programs in their schools because they see it helps kids who are feeling better about themselves so that they don't get into depression or anxiety, helping kids so they make better decisions of what they put in their bodies at second grade, you know, about food. They're not talking drugs at that point, but they're showing that it's having real impacts. So that's the work of this Promote Prevent Commission.
I'm going to back you up a couple of words, and you said, you know, you teach them about their bodies. It's, you know, what is your perception as to how we are educating our young minds about this disease, this epidemic? I am a proponent of somebody who feels that it should go younger than somebody who is in grade 5 and grade 6. And maybe we should, when we're teaching them the different colors of the crayons and the alphabet and their numbers and basic math, that maybe we try to somehow create basic positive images of them, almost like, you know, the war on drugs, don't, you know,
right.
just say no.
Right.
Is there, you know, a way to be able to get to our younger, so it's something that stays with them from the moment that somebody offers it to them?
It absolutely is. And to have evidence-based proven programs that work. Mm. With all due respect to people who did so much tremendous work with the DARE program and that, turns out it's not very effective. So there are programs, these communities of care and this other thing that starts in second grade called the Good Behavior Game. Yep. They're the ones that have 20 years of data. And what was great is we've had two of our hearings before, we were going to have the Surgeon General for the United States, who did a report and was talking of the need to be doing this, Kevin, as you point out, earlier in lives of folks. He, at the last minute, could not come. So U.S. Senator Ed Markey came and did the opening session a few months ago talking of what's happening at the federal level. We had experts, a second session, experts from around the state and, strike that, around the country, who came in to talk about what their models are in other states, California, Ohio, there's another down in the Florida area, So we learned a great deal about what they're doing. And the most recent one now is our Health Policy Commission. Because the three purposes, one is that we're investigating what really works, what's being done in other countries, what's being done in other states, get a whole list of those, what are evidence-based programs. The second is talking of how can we pay for these programs. And it could very well be the former president of Beth Israel Deaconess came and testified and said, we don't need more money necessarily. We can do it if we shift all the funds we spend when someone gets rushed to the hospital. So you know what? If we turn that upstream, we can do things earlier, save money, and actually have better outcomes for people. Mm. And then the third issue is thinking long-term, how we can measure the success. What I'm excited to tell you, Kevin, but we haven't announced it yet, is the Pew Charitable Trust came and monitored a few of our sessions, and MacArthur Foundation. Both of them have signed on now to help, and they're some of the folks who are doing nationwide work. They're going to be joining with us with our commission's work. We're very excited to we'll continue talking to you because we have a hearing coming up July 19th at the State House at 10 a.m. Okay. Open a session for anyone listening who wants to come up and testify.
Well, you're a regular participant on this program yourself, and there's a whole slew of South Shore legislators who I'm proud to say come on, whether they're in person, call in,
right,
to do the segment, and it's a great group, regardless if there's a D or an R next to the name, because here on Monday Night Talk, we try not to take a look at parties, but if we look at issues and what the individual is doing. And again, we're speaking with State Representative Jim Cantwell, friend of the show, someone who has been on the program many, many times over the years that we have been here on Monday Night doing Monday Night Talk. And probably the last thing I want to wrap up with is last week, I know that there was a lot of things in the news in regards to the legislature trying to do something in regards to putting more things in place in regards to recreational marijuana.
Correct.
And I don't know if that's in the realm of just strictly trying to find a way to fix a couple of things that were problems, especially when it came to taxing,
right,
this product.
Sure.
What is your understanding on this?
So my understanding is there's a conference committee. One thing that think back to when we had Just a Bill, Schoolhouse Rock.
Only a Bill.
I love so those. I do too. And the thing we learned about that, what it didn't tell you is when one branch passes one version of a bill, another branch passes a radically different one, what happens? Yeah. So we have a conference committee right now that's trying to work out some of the differences. But here's one of the things for folks to who are listening. We made sure that there was a law passed, 1.8 million folks in our state, not in my two towns. My two towns voted against it, but Question 4 passed last November. On the House side, we endorsed the idea that personal use for someone who's 21 years of age or older, they still will be able to possess up to 1 ounce of pot in public, 10 ounces at home. By the way, 1 ounce of pot, do you know how many joints that can be? Probably depends.
Please represent. Yeah. Tell us.
It probably depends how thickly people would roll them, but it could be 24 plus okay. Joints that folks can have. So
like a pack of cigarettes.
There we go. So that's already endorsed. People will still be able to have personal possession. Oh, and by the way, medicinal marijuana we endorsed years ago, and I personally support.
But there's confusion.
There's so much confusion.
There's a lot of confusion between medical marijuana and recreational, and I still see it prior to the law passing in November. And since.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hopefully there'll be a way down the road to be able to disseminate
correct information.
One.
I agree. Because and part of the reason for confusion is the proponents were using medicinal marijuana to get this passed. So I want people to know that we are going to keep the direction that people want of decriminalizing personal access for people 21 years of age or older. However, for premium and public health and safety, we want to make sure that we have guidelines for edibles. When I was a young person, marijuana only had about 5 or 6% THC content. It now can be in the 40% routinely and much higher when people do dabs and the like. What I'm excited about is we put aside $50 million that will come from taxation on marijuana that will fund what I just spoke about, prevention, trying to make sure that people understand why using marijuana before age 21 is very bad for brain development, how to use things appropriately, making sure that we don't see Joe Camel out there, you know, trying to promote marijuana to kids. If we look at right
gummy
now,
bears,
gummy
cookies,
bears, all those. None of that was really in the law that passed back in November. So we're trying to be the adults in the room to make sure that we have robust, common sense public health and a safety framework. And that would include doing some taxation that will be able to fund the governing body, the Cannabis Control Commission. I get it from folks that they want to have a number that will not encourage a black market, and that's what we're trying to work out to be a compromise.
Representative, thank you for coming in during this lengthy holiday weekend, so to speak, even though it is only Monday, and stopping in prior to going and enjoying yourself with your family. We wish you a happy Independence Day, a happy 4th of July.
Happy 3rd and 4th to everyone listening here tonight, too, Kevin. Thank you so very much for having me in, and hopefully I'll see people down in Brant Rock tonight as we revel in the 4th of July this whole weekend.
Excellent. All right. We are going to step aside. When we come back, we're going to meet another candidate running for council at large in the great town of Weymouth. You're listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
The South Shore's breaking news, weather, and traffic station.
95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Back in the 1950s, Grossman's in Braintree had sitting out in front of their lot a gigantic pile of intertwined wire cable. Neighborhood kids told one another it was an anti-submarine net used during World War II. Maybe the one at Pearl Harbor. Kids used to climb all over it. Very dangerous. Bill Buckley even took home a clip from it. He left it on his front porch and then forgot all about it. That was the summer of 1958. 40 years later, Bill was mowing his parents' lawn, a favor he enjoyed. Suddenly, the mower blade struck that clip and sent it smashing through his own windshield. When he picked it up from the front seat, he had no clue.
I'm Tiny of Tiny & Sons Glass. We come to your work or home, and we fix your windshield. Your insurance covers it. We're Tiny & Sons. My boys do a good job. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Well, thank you for staying with us on this 4th of July long holiday weekend. I know it's Monday, and I'm saying this, but thank you for staying for our next guest. It's kind of a theme past couple of weeks as we're hearing from folks who are running for office. We love having folks in who are running for office here on Monday Night Talk. This week, we are speaking with a gentleman who is running for councillor at large in the great... See, I always get confused, even though it's clarified every time I speak to somebody. I believe it's the city of Weymouth.
By charter, it's a city. We are the town of Weymouth.
And that voice is none other than Chris Primiano. And he is running. He's one of six people.
Correct.
Running for five seats. And at this juncture, at this particular time, that's all there is. And there's not going to be a preliminary, hopefully.
Hopefully not.
Not to be greedy, but hey, what the hell. I mean, if you can be planning for the general election, why not? If you will, tell the fine folks who are listening out there in Radio Land a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Kevin. Happy 4th of July to you.
Happy back to you.
Chris Primiano. I've been in Weymouth for about 13 years now. I've grew up in New York City, in Jackson Heights, Queens, and China, Maine, believe it or not. Kind of cultural shock going back and forth. But the last 13 years, we truly have made Weymouth our home. My wife, Brenda, and I are raising three children. We have our oldest just graduated from Norwich University. Uh-oh. Yeah, it was great. A product of Weymouth Public Schools. And Josh not only graduated from Norwich, the next day he was commissioned in the United States Navy. And he will be going to Pensacola in September, October to start flight school. He'll be a naval aviator.
Wow, that's significant.
Yeah, very significant. And, Josh has taught me a lot about service, and we'll probably talk a little bit about that coming up. But we have two other children. AJ, he's 15, sophomore at Weymouth High School. And Jordan will be a freshman at Weymouth High. And she's, you know, she's looking forward to joining her brother's alma mater.
I was going to interrupt you when you had mentioned being from New York. Are you a sports guy, and are your sports affiliations?
Red Sox, Patriots. Let's go.
Smart guy, knowing an election year here.
I was a Mets fan, but by the way, but not Yankees.
Okay, were you a Mets fan during 1986?
Yeah, no.
Okay, another smart answer. Tell why are you seeking office? What is driving you? And is this your first time?
Yeah, no, this is actually my third time running as a council at large. The first time, 6 years ago, was just because I was so aggravated at what was happening within our community and really wanted to get involved. Didn't know how to get involved, and it was surrounding the schools. Quite frankly, we're very, very frustrated where school funding was, where our directions are, schools were. People say, well, run for school committee. And then I realized the issue wasn't or didn't lie with the school committee itself, but more encompassing of the administration and such. And I put together a really quick campaign for council. It was really just more or less to raise awareness. I knew at that point I didn't know a lot of people, wasn't very previously very active within our community. So I knew I didn't have a good chance, but I thought I could get some message out. And a couple years ago, in the previous election, I mounted a very serious campaign and came in close to it. I was running against five incumbents and myself, and garnered nearly 6,000 votes and lost, which in a general election in Weymouth, 6,000 votes usually gets you in. It didn't this time. We were having a very contested mayoral race with then Senator Hedlund and Mayor Kay.
It's funny you say that. When you say 6,000 votes, I follow elections, whether they're some of the rural towns, whether it's Hanover, Norwell, Duxbury, or large communities like Quincy or Brockton. I think in Brockton, 6,000 votes, you would be near the top of the vote getters and would have secured, but there's only four at large councils, as opposed to five.
Sure.
In Weymouth, how has the political climate changed since you sought office, and what have you learned from your previous two attempts?
Well, to answer your first question, I think what we've seen so far is a night and day difference between what the previous administration did and what's going on now with the Hedlund administration. It's been a fantastic experience watching Weymouth grow over the last 18 months or so. We've really been able to do a lot with not much more money, quite frankly. It's a business approach to things, reaching out and getting as much grant money as possible and creating, and last night I was at one, is really creating a collaborative effort with the community, with community forums on what's the vision of the town, where we're heading, and how to get there, quite frankly, and bringing that community collaboration into play.
I guess I would ask you this, and, you know, knowing that Weymouth, where it is here in the South Shore, and I think it falls in line with Braintree in Quincy, folks who are willing to commute into Boston, and folks who don't want to pay what the exorbitant rents are.
Sure.
Like to, instead of, I mean, it depends on your style, it depends on how far you want to travel. Folks who want to be close to the city but don't want to live in the city, Weymouth is one of those quintessential communities that is fortunate enough to have folks who are, you know, commuting back and forth and want to call Weymouth their home.
I couldn't agree more. And when we decided, when we were in Indiana for about 4 years before we came back east, we chose Weymouth to live at. We decided that it had everything to offer. It was close to Boston. It's close to it's close to the ocean. It's close to the mountains of New Hampshire. It is a hidden gem on the South Shore. And I think right now it's becoming to be more and more, our visibility status is increasing. You're seeing More houses. We're seeing development at Union Point. I sit on the board of directors for the South Shore Redevelopment Authority, so I see what's kind of coming into it with the potential of ProDrive, which is our largest commercial tenant so far, will be tenant once we break ground, or once Union Point breaks ground on it. That's going to be a fantastic catalyst for the entire community.
Okay, we're speaking with Chris Primiano. He is a candidate for council at large in Weymouth, and we're talking about his candidacy and his run for office here on this Monday Night Talk, this July 3rd show. And so you're staying on Union Point, Chris.
Sure.
Are you happy with the transformation of Union Point? Because we know for a while there was kind of a lot of questions, and it wasn't until we saw it change hands as far as folks who are managing it, where now we get Union Point, and it seems as though the three communities are kind of navigating the old naval air base, that there is movement, and it seems as going in a positive direction. Would you agree with that statement?
I do. Overall, I definitely do. I think what you've seen up until the last couple of years has been 18, 20 years of frustration. Over the last couple of years, LSTAR, who is the latest master developer and hopefully the last master developer of the community, has really brought some credibility to the former Southfield, South Weymouth Naval Air Station. With the commercial tenant of ProDrive breaking ground relatively soon, we're seeing the Parks and Rec piece being done. Currently, Shea has been shut down as they continue the construction on those pieces. Sure. We have a couple major Cochran buildings going up currently, and more and more developers are looking at the facility. As you know, the legislation was changed to allow further expansion, not only in Weymouth, but also in Rockland and Abington. And it was so important that the three communities look at this not as what is good for my community, but good for the entire South Shore, because this will drive economic development that we all need throughout the communities.
And that's, I think, a staple for a lot of communities is how can we maximize economic development? How do you feel that Weymouth can best maximize its opportunities when it comes to economic development, whether it's in Union Point or the various areas in the community?
In my last campaign, I stressed that economic development was the catalyst for turning communities around, providing funds and revenue necessary to fund schools, public safety, et cetera. In a recent forum that we had on economic development, we talked about zoning, quite frankly, and rezoning certain corridors within Weymouth, whether it's Route 18, 3A, 53, anywhere the communities, the traffic into the communities need to be rezoned for better development, whether it's a mixed-use facility where there may be businesses on the bottom, some residential on top, and structure it so developers want to put commercial entity in Weymouth. It's so important. We need to maximize our potential within those corridor communities.
So let's say in November you are elected. What would you feel would be your primary focus, your specialty, something that you would want to work on during your first term that you feel is unique onto yourself as an individual, but yet is going to best serve Weymouth?
I think really looking at with the administration is the long-term development of Weymouth. Where's the vision? Where are we headed and how best we can get there? My business background allows me to see things sometimes other people don't. And working with the Economic Development Subcommittee, I think it would best suit me in helping drive some of those business entities, as well as the unique I've had the unique opportunity as Mayor Hedlund's appointee onto the Southfield Redevelopment Authority to see what's coming up there too, and really working that through the council and bring that to the table.
What is your relationship been with the mayor? Again, you're talking about being an appointee courtesy of Mayor Bob Hedlund. Kind of describe your relationship and how you would look forward to working with he and his administration on various projects.
Yeah, I think we have a very good relationship. We talk the same language as far as...
Wait, are you a Phillies fan?
I am not a Phillies fan. Okay, that's funny. Yeah, Mayor Hedlund and I, I've known each other for several years now, and we've definitely enjoyed the same sort of thought process of where Weymouth needs to go as far as business is concerned, where we can bring additional revenues in and still see the importance and the necessary need to fund our public safety and our DPW and improve our schools. And so our political philosophy as far as the town is concerned is really in sync with each other. As a town councilor, my obligation, however, is to serve those constituents that I represent and making sure that the administration hears their concerns as agendas move forward.
You had mentioned something earlier on in our conversation in regards to involvement and even taking a look at maybe being a school committee member because of whether you were dissatisfied with funding or how it was going. Give me your thoughts on education and how Weymouth is moving forward in regards, or there are areas of need that you hope that you can be a part of helping to address.
Yeah. I think Weymouth has always, or in the last 7 or 8 years, has really been challenged with the funding of our school systems. And it's not going away anytime soon. One of the things that has changed, though, is how the administration has looked at budgeting the schools, changing it from a let's backfill free cash approach to funding things up front so you can add more staff. You can't add staff in January, February of the following year as free cash becomes available. So this administration has taken a proactive approach of front-loading the school systems and changing the accounting mentality, I guess is probably the easiest way to put it, okay, of how schools should be funded. That being said, there's a lot of work to be done, raising test scores, ensuring that the student to teacher ratio starts to decline a little bit. There's some concern about how high it can be, or in some instances. So there's much work to be done, but we're much closer than we were 3 or 4 years ago.
What do you feel that the town itself can do, whether it's the administration, mm-hmm, the town or city council, however you want to deem it?
Town council
can work in unity and maybe with other communities around the Commonwealth. I hear the current cry from a lot of communities that they feel that there's still a major issue with the funding formula when it comes to local aid Chapter 70 money that's given to, you know, towns and cities to be able to provide an education. Give me your thoughts.
Definitely agree. We need to work with our state delegation, Senator O'Connor, Representative Murphy, Representative Mariano, and really trying to boost that local aid up. I know Governor Baker hears the call and the crying of a lot of communities. However, that money has not trickled back down to our communities yet. We need more money to fund our schools, and until that happens, we need to have other revenue, and that's where the economic development comes in. We need more money to fund our schools at this point. That being said, we have a ton of great educators, administrators within our community, and that's kind of a saving grace at this point. We have good people working in our schools.
Okay. We get about 3 or 4 minutes left. It's been a fast segment here on the 4th of July edition, even though it's July 3rd, of Monday Night Talk. Is there an issue issues that you want to kind of touch upon real quick?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. North Weymouth Compressor Station. I would be remiss big one, huge one. Although there was a win recently with the canceling Access Northeast, or suspension of it, by Spectra, Enbridge, or whatever name they're going by today. That's a huge step, and a really shout out for all the people who have been really advocating to shut that project down. One down, one to go. So that's been that's terrific. And quite frankly, I'd like to be able to look at the overall community of continue to make things better for us. And I know that's a very general statement, but we're on a roll right now, and we need to continue that roll over the next 2, 3, 4 years and continue to drive the development that's that's happening within our community. I know if you go in our neighborhood currently, you're seeing people reinvest in their homes, whether it's knocking it down, putting additions on, painting, re-landscaping. So there's a sense of pride. There's a sense of pride that's happening in Weymouth within our communities. We need to protect that integrity of our community. And I definitely, as your town councilor to my listening audience right now, that's my goal.
How about a little known fact about you, a fun fact about Chris Primiano? And again, whether it's a family thing, whether it's a recreational thing, just, you know, what a regular guy kind of a thing that you want to share with. Again, this is your opportunity to connect to voters.
Wow, you're putting me on the spot.
Well, that's the purpose of a radio show.
Let's see. Little known thing.
A little known thing, or maybe just a fun fact about
I used
about
to fly you. Planes.
Get out of here.
Really?
Small planes or big
small,
planes?
Small planes. Okay. To me, they were big at the time, but no, small planes.
To all of us, they are.
Exactly. Kind of, you know, really, yeah. really enjoyed it. It was a great hobby, good way to think about life. You get up into a plane, you know, 10,000 feet, and just kind of relax and just kind of, you know, the sky is your, you know, the sky is in front of you, and just relax and see.
Give us a story about your most interesting flight.
Oh, wow. Here we go. Okay, I was flying up in northern Maine.
By yourself, with a friend, family?
By myself.
Okay.
And in northern Maine, when you look down, all you're seeing is trees. And I'm flying visual flight rules, so that means you're just kind of flying by sight. And I have a kneeboard with has the map to show me where I was. And for a good 5 minutes, I forgot where I was. Which is fine, because, you know, you have coast on one side probably at some point, and, well, actually more woods on the left. But thanks to a local radio station that I knew of, I dialed in and vectored toward the beacon and found my way to the highway and followed it home.
So you didn't land on the highway?
I did not land on the highway, okay. And I don't know if I ever told anybody that story before.
Well, you just did to thousands of people who
terrific.
At home while they're cooking up burgers and dogs on this Monday night. I want to thank you so much for joining us here. If folks want to find out more about your campaign, if they want to reach out, if they want to volunteer, whatever the purpose is, website, social media, what do you do?
Yes. Website, www.primiano, P-R-I-M-I-A-N-O, four, towncouncil.com. I'm on Facebook. I post on Facebook. I answer on Facebook, so please feel free to reach out to me.
He does. He actually is like, hey. So, like, I hear you get candidates, like, coming on. Is there a way? And I'm like, yeah, I think I actually answered you that day.
You did.
To say, oh, well, I try to do it with anybody. Anybody who reaches out. I mean, there's no rhyme or no reason, but if somebody asks, and I've throughout the years, I should say, anybody who has asked to come on, I try to do my best to make sure I get them on, and I try to be fair, and I ask folks to spread the word. If you know of a candidate who's running for office, doesn't matter what the office is. I mean, if it's 2 years down the road, I don't know if I'm one of those, but I will say that we are open. I mean, that's the idea. This is a community show. I pride myself in having a variety of guests. I mean, we got some great guests on here. I mean, we had Jimmy Cantwell on prior to you, and we got Barbara Mandoloni, who's going to be joining us in just a few moments. So we thank you very much, Chris, for coming in, and your silent partner, Brenda, who happened to pop in with you to be a part of the show this evening.
Thanks, Kevin. I really appreciate it.
You got it. All right. We are going to step aside just for a moment here. But when we come back, hour number two of Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Don't go anywhere.
Is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman is a great place to unwind any night of the week. Stop in for Singo on Monday night. There's the always popular Irish Sessions every Tuesday night, half-price pizza every Wednesday night, and Friday and Saturday nights feature the best in live entertainment. Catch your favorite game on McGuigan's 8 big flat screens and enjoy a pint at their beautiful 54-foot mahogany bar. Whether you're a regular or coming in for the first time, you're always a friend of McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street, Whitman Center.
This Sunday, travel back in time to 1945 at the Buckley Performing Arts Center on the Brockton campus of Massasoit College for a night of radio and television classics live. A star-studded cast will perform scripts from classic shows like Burns and Allen, Duffy's Tavern, and The Jimmy Durante Show. Special guest star John Astin from TV's The Addams Family will take the stage along with plenty of other local celebrities. Tickets are $18 with discounts for seniors, students, and groups. Buy yours online now. Visit massasoit.edu/boxoffice.
Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Well, thank you for staying with us for the second hour of Monday Night Talk, your 4th of July edition, even though it is July 3rd. And we get a great second hour, starting with the president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, Barbara Madaloni. She's going to be joining us in just a second. And author Dean Koontz, going to talk a little bit about his new book, The Silent Corner. I just like doing that, The Silent Corner. All right, so last year we were able to speak with our next guest, who is actually attending a National Education Association Representative Assembly. And just a little bit about the NEA. It is the nation's largest professional employee organization, which represents 3 million elementary and secondary teachers, higher education faculty, education support professionals, school administrators, retired educators, and students preparing to become teachers. We welcome Barbara to the show. Welcome back, Barbara.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Did you bring anything from your last time that you were at the Representative Assembly?
Bring anything. Just lots of good ideas and opportunities to take action to defend public education. That's what we're doing.
And just so folks know, kind of give us the Cliff's Notes version as to what the NEA's Representative Assembly is.
It is our democratic body. We meet once a year with representatives from all the constituencies you just named. And basically, we debate, discuss, and vote on policies and the direction that we want the NEA to take for the next year. It's an incredibly democratic process. Almost 8,000 delegates from across the country, including Alaska and Hawaii, coming and talking about public education and what we need to do to defend it and make every opportunity for every child to have a high-quality public education.
And of course, folks, we're going to be giving you basically a snapshot of what's going to be happening. But if you want to find out more about the NEA or even what's happening at the Representative Assembly or the RA, you can go to www.nea.org. Also, I believe they have a Twitter hashtag NEARA17. Is that correct, Barbara?
Yeah, I believe, is it NEARA17 or 2017? No. I'll have to check.
Ooh, you have to
you
check.
You probably know better than I do.
Well, according to my notes that were sent to me, that's what I have here, but
that's great.
I will tell you what, if after our conversation here that it's incorrect when we put the podcast up, let me know and I'll make sure that I put that in the notes for the podcast.
Excellent.
So if you could, knowing that we have a new administration down at D.C., I'm sure there's going to be a lot of conversation.
There is going to be a lot of conversation, and it's interesting. We just had our first Massachusetts sends a delegation of upwards of 200 members, and so we just had our first caucus meeting. And I think what's interesting in terms of the nature of the conversation is that people understand very clearly that public education and public sector unions are under a profound attack under this administration and are needing, we need to sort of organize to defend public education, to defend our unions, our right to collectively bargain. At the same time, there's an interesting sense of hope and possibility that things have been exposed, efforts to privatize, more and more people understand that. They understand the nature of the attack. And more and more people are willing to sort of step forward, speak out, and organize. So it's a curious blend of anxiety and concern and a real sense of possibility.
And especially here in Massachusetts, it seems that there's more of a push by our current governor who wants to go with charter schools. I would think that falls in the realm, yes?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I say to people all the time is that we understand that at the national level, President Trump and Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos present a significant threat to public education, but we're already living under that threat here in Massachusetts with a governor who supported the attempt to raise the cap on charter schools last fall, which we successfully defeated, with a Secretary of Education who does not support the Fair Share Amendment, which would bring more resources into public schools, Secretary of Education, who is a privatizer and wants more focus on high-stakes testing, not less. So we have our own struggles here. But again, going back to actually the defeat of the ballot question last November, we also have people who begin to understand what's happening, and we have a real sense that people in Massachusetts value public education and want to fight for it and want it to be fully funded. And that's a key issue, and I think the movement to fully fund public education in Massachusetts is really going to take off.
And not to compound the matters, but, you know, the conversation that we hear on a regular basis from municipalities, especially in the springtime when, you know, if it's a part of the democratic process, whether it's a city or a town council, or if it's a town meeting representative type of government, is that there's not enough Chapter 70 monies that's for funding public education. And there are a lot of communities that there's an outcry, that there's an issue yet again with the funding formula, even though I know that I think at the tail end of Deval Patrick's time in office as governor, they did look at it, and there's a two-year turnaround for them to look at it, evaluate it, and tweak it. There's still concerns, correct?
Oh, the concerns are profound. I was on a bipartisan commission that reported out in 2016 that the foundation budget is underfunded by upwards of $2 billion a year. That has real consequences for our school districts. If we look at Brockton, they're laying off 100 educators in Brockton. Think about what that means. Think about what that means in terms of class sizes and student accessibility to teachers, what that means in terms of the maintenance of our buildings. There are real consequences. And if it's not in Brockton, it's all the way out in Western Mass in the Pioneer Valley Regional School up in Northfield, where they were laying off, they pink-slipped one-third of the educators in the regional school. This is an emergency for us in terms of fully funding our schools. And if we're committed to public education and committed to young people and our future, we have to find a way to fund our schools.
It's funny, you hit a bullseye with talking about Brockton. As somebody who covers the Brockton area, I know that this past budget that was just passed by the Brockton City Council, the school committee had to put forth a budget that was, there was a $16 million deficit. Of that $16 million, $5 million of that budget can be blamed towards the opening of a new charter school in the city.
Absolutely. A charter school that was opened over the objection of the school committee, of the city council, of the state representative and the state senators in Brockton. So the degree, you know, when we talk about privatizing, I think that word, sometimes people don't quite understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the charter school in Brockton is a perfect example. Public education is not only foundational to democracy in terms of it's the space where we help young people understand what it means to participate in democracy, but it's also a democratic institution. We have school committees that are elected that oversee our public schools. And when you have a charter school, you eliminate the democratic process from schooling and the funds that are public funds go into private hands of a private board that can make decisions and does make decisions out of the eye of the public and of elected officials. And Brockton is a painfully poignant example of that. And the, and now that means in Brockton, which already had eliminated librarians in their middle school, what does that mean in terms of the quality of education that the great majority of students in Brockton are being offered? And incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, and you're talking about also a school system that over probably the past decade has received its accolades. There have been many news reports on its successes, and you only ask yourself if because of the financial the direness of the financial instability, if there's going to be problems down the road with it maintaining such high standards as it has, if it's going to end up having larger class sizes and less staff and faculty to be able to provide that to those young minds that need to be cultivated.
I really appreciate you mentioning that, because Brockton really has been held up as an example of a school where the educators there like really work to say, we're going to do everything that we can to make this a high-quality school. And they took some, they made some sacrifices in order to do that. And what is the answer to that? Taking more funds out of the school. There's something absolutely, I'm going to use the word criminal about that. People need to be thinking about that there's a real human beings, students, educators, parents, and community that are experiencing significant losses because of the funds being taken out of the Brockton Public Schools and put into the charter school over the objection of the people of Brockton.
Yeah, we're speaking with Barbara Madaloni. She is the president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, and she is attending the National Education Association's 155th annual meeting in the 96th Representative Assembly. This is going to be held here in Boston, right, Barbara?
Absolutely. We're at the convention center, and you'll see educators all over the city as we're gathering and enjoying Boston.
You're a lucky gal. You're
doing our work.
You don't have to travel that far this year.
I did not have travel. I had travel about a mile and a half. but who knows how long it took me with the traffic.
So I want to kind of a segue from talking about privatization policies to talking about another conversation that will be taking place, empowering educators in the communities that they serve to be able to make decisions about public education. Talk to me. Give us the ideas and the conversations that are going to flow.
I think the thing that's so important to understand about sort of the context of public education right now, right here in Massachusetts, is the degree to which we have created this bureaucratic accountability system that, in particular with a focus on high-stakes testing, that has taken the power of educators out of the classroom. Like, they don't have the same opportunity to use their professional knowledge and expertise to make decisions about curriculum, to make decisions about their pedagogical practice. Across Massachusetts, educators are frightened. They feel threatened because test scores are being held over their head as the measure of what it means to teach and learn. They feel powerless to object because of those threats. There's a standardization of curriculum that comes with the standardization of high-stakes testing. And it really is profoundly detrimental to the young people in our classrooms. Now, saying all that, I will say that it's amazing the work that our educators continue to do in spite of those conditions, because they know their students best, they know their content best, they know what it means to teach their content to students, whether they're in fourth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, graduating from high school. And we're really committed to fighting for the return of professional autonomy and respect and dignity in our schools, in our buildings. And we're going to do that at the local level, and we're going to do it with parents and students, because parents and students respect teachers in the way that the bureaucracy doesn't. So we're excited about organizing around that to fight for the schools our communities deserve.
We know that educators have to face federal mandates, whether it's a No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, and now the new Every Student Succeeds Act. I think of, we're sitting here, we're about to face another Affordable Care Act, where the federal government kind of looms over, wanting to make sure that the states do what they're supposed to when it comes to providing health care, instead of, if we remember back when health care was in its before Obamacare, Massachusetts had its own and it was able to manage. I guess I want you to give me a compare and contrast to states being able to manage how to educate compared to having to live by a standard that the federal government puts forth.
Well, we're actually in an interesting place in that right now, because Betsy DeVos, as our Secretary of Education at the federal level, is so interested in undermining public education and putting public funds into private hands for private schools, that her tactics are not, I don't think, going to be the same. They're just going to move towards vouchers, and they're going to move towards more charter schools. And they're sort of less interested at the national level, I think, in using the accountability as the way to get to that end. Here in Massachusetts, however, we're continuing to use a focus, a sort of laser, bizarre, I would call it a kind of madness focus, on high-stakes testing as the measure of what's happening in a school, and narrowing sort of our sense of what's possible in schools, and then using test scores to punish districts, to punish teachers, punish students, and ultimately withdraw funds and say, look, we've proved that these schools are failing by using these test scores, and now we're going to put funding into a private interest in order through charter schools. And we're going to say that's where our money is going to go. So we're really in a critical position about that. So in the past, the federal government was in danger in terms of the accountability measures. Right now, the danger in Massachusetts is here at the state level.
So something definitely, there has to be a conversation. There needs to be corrective actions taken I would think that's what the conversation would be. How can it be better managed? Because while you're sitting here and you're talking about this and you're going the voucher way, I almost see it's almost like writing giving a blank check on, all right, yeah, just let me know how you spent it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that we need to understand about this in terms of the statewide level is that our Secretary of Education doesn't share our commitment to public education, doesn't have a faith in professional educators to do the work, doesn't have a faith in our communities to make decisions about what they want through a democratic process. What we're doing within the MTA is we're saying we have faith in the democratic process, we have faith in our educators, parents, and students, and we want to actually work to not just resist the privatization, but we want to create the schools, a vision for the schools our communities deserve. So we're holding conversations across the state to say to people, what ideally do you want for your school? What's the purpose of public education? What do you want students to come home and tell you about the day that they just had? And let's stop talking about testing and hyper-accountability and austerity mindsets and start talking about what our students deserve, what our communities deserve, and how we're going to fight for that vision.
Again, you're listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Also, we can be heard the World Wide Web, 959WATD.com. And we are speaking with the president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, Barbara Madaloni, and she's talking about the representative assembly that she will be attending. And we're talking about funding, we're talking about financing. I know we're talking about K through 12, but I think also part of the conversation that's going to take place is higher education. our public colleges and universities. Where will the conversation go with that?
Well, if we talk about that first at the state level, which is critical, it's where our funding comes from for public higher ed. Here in Massachusetts, since 2001, we are underfunding our public higher education by 30%. That's profound. Massachusetts, you know, everyone who comes to the assembly here is like, oh, Massachusetts, you lead the country in higher education and pre-K-12 education. Well, we're underfunding our public institutions of higher education. And so funding is absolutely key. The other things that we'll be talking about are free public higher education. There is a movement across the country and here within Massachusetts to say, just like pre-K 16, 12 has to be free as public higher public education, we need the same now that our colleges need to be free. And that's, we're beginning to plant that flag and move toward that vision. And then as well, for so many of our members who are working in public higher education, who are adjuncts, who are part-time, who are being paid less than minimum wage to do the work with few benefits, no pensions, we're going to be fighting for equal pay for equal work. That is part of a national movement for adjuncts and part-time faculty, and I'm sure that'll be on our agenda as well.
While we're talking about faculty, or talking about folks who are getting into education, how about new educators? From what I understand here, public schools, we could see more than 2 million new educators who'll be entering the workforce over the next, what, 5 years?
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's exciting. As somebody who taught high school and then also was a teacher educator, it's great to see that in spite of the degree to which educators are being attacked by the right wing, so many young people really understand that education is a critical place to commit to the community and want to become educators. So we are working to reach out to them, to bring them in, and to help them understand that part of doing the work of being an educator is joining in collective action to fight for our students and to fight for our schools. And I think new educators really understand that. They're very close to the idealism that brings them into the profession. And people come to be educators out of a broader sense of values and commitment to something bigger than themselves. And to the degree that we make a space for them to sort of hold on to those ideals, we'll be able to bring them in to help us fight to defend public education.
When you talk about this new generation of educators, it's so much different than 10, 20, 30 years ago, correct? I would think that there's going to be some conversation in that area too, yeah?
Absolutely. And, I think that it kind of cuts a variety of different ways, good and bad, right? I mean, it's so many educators, people who've been in the field for 15, 20 years, talk about how they've lost their power in their classroom. You know, I was talking about earlier, like we have to return to professional autonomy and respect, and we need new educators to understand that that's their right and that we have to organize together to fight for that. We also are under, pressure given the sort of context of technology and how it's impacting the classroom, that there are sort of edupreneurs within ed tech who are really interested in going into our classrooms and dehumanizing them. It becomes a part of the deprofessionalization of education, that everything becomes computer-based, Chromebooks replace teachers, replace face-to-face. So we have a lot of sort of a critical moment to make sure that we maintain our professional autonomy and respect our voices and the human factor of people coming together in community that is the core of teaching and learning. There's a lot of work to do. I think people are ready to do it, as I said earlier.
Barb, we just got a couple of minutes left, but I don't want to exit this conversation with you without at least touching on another topic that's going to be discussed at the RA, and that is racial and social justice. Could you touch upon that for a moment to kind of give an idea as to where that conversation is going to go? Because it's important.
It's absolutely important, and it is the frame for all of the work that we do in public education, and that is that our commitment to our students and our communities has to be a commitment to economic justice and to racial justice. And the NEA 2 years ago passed a resolution to really make the focus on institutional racism and economic justice a core of who we are as educators and the work that we're doing as unionists. An example of what that looks like is that just this morning, delegates from certainly from Massachusetts and from other states were out supporting some workers who were arrested in Vermont. These are immigrant workers who did not have papers, who were arrested after protesting. These are workers who are going to be receive an award from the NEA for human and civil rights efforts, and they're arrested by ICE. And we had educators out there saying, we welcome you, we are going to defend you and support your right to speak out and protest working conditions. That's an example of the kind of work that we're doing now to really say we are allied with our community around economic and racial justice issues. And as educators, we have to stand with you, not only in terms of fighting for public education, but in terms of fighting for your safety and for your economic security.
We got about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left, and this is your opportunity. We like here at WATD, especially during the South Shore's morning news, we have a segment called a segment that allows folks to come in and take the bullhorn and kind of present a message to whomever may be listening. If you could send a message using Monday Night Talk, using this segment, to Massachusetts elected officials about one thing educators need, what would that be?
Educators need a real commitment in terms of resources to public education, pre-K through higher ed. If we believe in and value the mission of public education, the Massachusetts Constitution, which says we will cherish public education, we will cherish it by providing the resources and the professional autonomy we need to do our work.
Is there a website that you can give to folks who want to find out more information?
Go to NEA.org to find out more about the representative assembly, and massteacher.org to find out more about the issues that we're fighting for in the NCA.
Now, other than attending the RA, do you got any you got any plans for the fourth holiday, or is it a matter of you're going to be locked down in conversation?
We are going to be locked down in conversation. It's an all-day event, all-day, four-day event. But it's democracy at work. What else do you want on the 4th of July? That's a
Amen.
Good democratic conversation.
Barbara, I got to tell you, it was, again, fun to be able to talk to you. It was informative. Definitely would like to have you on maybe before the beginning of the school year. Maybe we can have a conversation as to where things stand with the MTA and education, and just to have a general conversation.
I would love an opportunity to do that, and we've got a lot of plans for the next school year. So, yeah, let's be in touch.
Excellent. There she is, Barbara Maddaloni. She has been our guest. She is the president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, and she is attending the National Education Association's 155th annual meeting and 96th representative assembly, which is going to be going until July 5th here in Boston. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, our final segment here on Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD. Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk for our final segment, probably the best segment of the evening. Joining us is number one New York Times bestselling author Dean Koontz, and he's here to discuss his new suspense novel, The Silent Corner, which is the first in a new series, which is already optioned for television. Welcome to Monday Night Talk, Mr. Koontz.
Thanks for having me there.
So I want to ask you, you're known as probably one of the most widely read authors. You have over 500 million copies sold in 38 languages. At one point in your life, did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
Strangely enough, it goes back to when I was, at least to when I was 8 years old. And when I was 8 years old, I started writing stories on tablet paper and drawing the cover and stapling the left edge and covering the staples with tape so nobody would prick their fingers, and then tried to sell those to relatives for a nickel. So it began very early with me. I was the writer, the publisher, the agent, the bookseller, all of that in one. And I've never been 100% sure where that came from, because there were no books in our house.
Okay. Well, we recently, you know, we like having authors on from time to time, and Hank Philippi Ryan, who is actually an investigative reporter for a local Boston area television station, now has found her groove as a mystery writer. I got to ask you, what was your career early on until you achieved enough success just to be a full-time writer?
Well, I sold my first short story when I was a senior in college, and it had won a prize in a contest that the at that time the Atlantic Monthly sponsored for college student writers, and it was very nice to get the certificate and the praise from the English department, but there was not a dollar associated with the prize. And I took the same story and sold it in those days for $50, which was much more than the now, when paperbacks back then cost 50 cents.
Right.
I thought, wow, here I get 100 paperbacks. That was not going to be enough to keep me alive, but I started selling science fiction short stories and novels, mostly paperbacks. And because I had read those as almost my exclusive genre as a child, but by the time I got to be, I think I was about 25 or something like that, I realized that this isn't what I wanted to be writing for the future. So I gave that up, and my wife made me this offer. She said, I know you want to write. You're proving you can do it, and I think you can make a living at it. And let's see. She said, I'll support you for 5 years, and if you can't make it in 5 years, you can never make it. And I tried to negotiate up to 7, but she has Sicilian blood, so she always wins those kind of negotiations. And about 5 years later, she was able to quit her job and go to work here running things like the whole financial side of everything. So it took quite a while. People think you've been a bestseller for a long time, that it was overnight, but it was not, by no means overnight.
Okay. It's rumored that you read approximately 200 books a year, and you probably have a little over 40,000 books in your library. What types of books catch your interest?
Well, that's probably a little thing you've read from early on. The first couple of decades we were married, we each read about 200 books a year. Most of them were fiction at that time, but that had a lot to do with how I learned to write fiction, was reading so much of it in so many different genres. But now I read a great deal for research, especially on this new series, these Jane Hawk books, starting with The Silent Corner. There's a huge amount of stuff I needed to research in every level. And it's funny, because when I was a kid in high school and college, I hated going to the library, doing research, and I always faked it. I made fake resources and put footnotes to books and authors who didn't even exist. It's something I'm not terribly proud of, but and years passed where nobody ever caught me at it. And now I find, as a as an adult and working, writing fiction, that the research is one of the things I love the most. So finally, I'm maturing.
See, today you're known, the world knows you as a marvelous storyteller. But there was a time that you actually delved into science fiction novels. like StarQuest and Demon Seed, which you wrote in 73 and then rewrote in 1997. Is the creative process any different than writing suspense novels?
I'd say it's different in writing every kind of novel. When I gave up the science fiction, I bought back the rights to all books except Demon Seed. I couldn't get that back, and put them out of print forever so there'd be no confusion. And then I was writing suspense. I moved from that into writing things with somewhat of a supernatural bent, also started introducing comedy to them. And now it's sort of, right now with this series, I'm sort of flat out grab you by the throat suspense, but also is about some serious issues. And I've found over the years that as I've changed the kind of thing I write, each one requires something different of you, but in a way, nothing less. It's why I often say literary fiction is simply a different genre from mysteries or from science fiction or from suspense. They all require something considerable from you as a writer if you're going to do it well.
Okay. We're speaking with the number one New York Times bestselling author, Dean Koontz. He's here to discuss his new suspense novel, The Silent Corner. Now, in the newest book, which hit the stores on June 20th, we meet Jane Hawk, FBI agent gone rogue. If you will, share with our listeners a little background on this fascinating character.
Well, I sat down. Sometimes you know where a book, what the seed for it was, and sometimes you don't. And in this case, I didn't. I knew I wanted to write a story featuring a female FBI agent on leave or maybe gone rogue. By the end of book one, she's totally rogue. But I didn't know what it was going to be about or what it was that impelled her into this. And I thought I would write it in little moments, like smaller scenes, so that instead of introducing a character, telling you about the character, and setting up the storyline or the central conflict, that I would just follow her through a series of small scenes, letting her reveal a little bit about herself here and a little bit about herself there, and also raise more questions about her as you learn things. And I'd never got a story going that way before, and by the time I was probably, I'd say 20 pages into it, I knew I had a very uninteresting character here. And the way it evolved as those early chapters got going was I realized Jane was on the road alone. She on the road alone because her husband, a career Marine at the age of 32 and a full colonel, the youngest in the Marine Corps, killed himself, and she has never believed he killed himself. And she's looking into his suicide and discovers there are all these suicide rate has escalated in the U.S., and there's about 8,000 additional suicides a year than usual, and these are almost exclusively among people who are successful in their fields, happily married or happy in their other circumstances, and never been depressed, and that fits the profile of her husband. So she, at that point, very much wants to know what's going on here. And that's when she and, give a tiny plot point away in the first one, she and her 5-year-old son come under threat. And Jane has to hide out her child and try to understand what's going on, and pretty soon becomes the most wanted fugitive in America. The character just, I laugh, I say sometimes I've been married 50 years, and this is the second time I've fallen in love with a woman, but this one's fictional, so it's not going to lead to divorce. And Jane is just the most fascinating character I've ever gotten. I'm working on book 4 with her, and it's the combination of her toughness. She's as tough as it gets, but also has this enormous good heart and a tender side, and all of this together. I don't know how long I can write about Jane and be fascinated, but so far, book by book, I'm more fascinated each time I go back to her.
And you actually, one of my questions was, is it true that that Jane has become one of your favorite characters to write about? Why is that, that she is so fascinating, and what makes her different than any other of the other characters that you have written about in the past?
Well, I've written many women character leads, but in this one, I tend to let characters describe who they are. I don't sit down with character notes. I don't start with a plot outline. And if a character comes on the scene, I know, in this case, I knew it wanted to be this woman FBI agent. I knew almost immediately she was widowed. But I let her tell me who she is. And if I can, what fascinates me is all kind of elements about her. But I know one of the things that fascinates other people, because so many in my publishing life, from my editor to my publishers here and elsewhere, they come back to her wit, and I don't mean by that necessarily her humor, although she has a very dry wit, but they mean that she is, one of them said to me, how, she is so intelligent, she figures these things out, and how did you get that? I said, well, Jane can figure something out in 1 minute to do, and you go, wow, that was cool. But I sit here for 4 days trying to figure out what that'll be. I'm unfortunately not as intelligent as Jane, but it's her intelligence, her cleverness that partly drives this. And then I've gotten a lot of feedback. My editor said, I just love the way she talks to the bad guys. Mm. And I will say, I've never seen another character, I've certainly never written one, who talks to people in the way that Jane does. And there's just something about her attitude that is just so enormously appealing. I'm getting a lot of fan mail on the book now that it's been out a week. And there's a thing repeated where people say, I wish she was real. I wish she was a friend of mine. And that's what I think makes her appeal to me. I wish I had friends who were this tough-minded, and yet this sensitive, and underlying it so sweet. And yet, she walks a very fine line. Sometimes you think she's stepping over a line here and doing something I don't approve of, until you follow her through it, and you realize, no, she never goes too far over the line. And that's another thing in an age when often characters in these roles of police authority are portrayed as corrupt. Jane is not corrupt, but when she's dealing with very corrupt people, she knows how to play on their level.
How much research did you have to put in to Jane Hawk in order to, you know, develop that fine line between her, that tough exterior, but yet she has a sensitive side too?
Well, there was an enormous amount of research based on the very fact that once Jane is, she takes leave of absence, but when she suddenly, it's no longer a leave of absence, and she's being hunted by let's call it a conspiracy or a cabal. It's part government, part private industry, and they're trying to hide something of great importance to the future of the world. And she has to go off the grid, and that became a big research issue. And in figuring out how she goes off the grid, how she can use the internet but not be caught or tracked, how she can use a car because she has to use one with no GPS. She can't use a regular cell phone, and she can't even use a burner phone for any protracted length of time in a metropolitan area because the NSA has a way of tracking even burner phones if they're used too consecutively. It's all these things that I had to learn about, and I found out very quickly that all the people who think they're off the grid aren't off the grid at all. And these preppers we see on TV, they're nowhere near off the grid. And so when Jane had to learn to be almost invisible, and there's always somebody at her heels because there's people just as smart as she is trying to catch her. She's no superwoman. When I had to research all that, it started refining all sides of Jane. It had to bring her, she had to be a lot more clever than I probably would have originally written her. And as that cleverness came in, as the intelligence grew in the character, I think it sharpened both her toughness and her tenderness, because I've always felt that if you combine intelligence with common sense, you get some of the best people you know. But if you have intelligence with no common sense, there you've got a master criminal.
If I can add a little addendum to the what you just said, this is straight out of your book before, part one, Rock Me. Those who are truly off the grid and cannot be tracked by any technology yet are able to move about freely and use the internet are said to be in the silent corner. That's straight out of your book, which is well said. That kind of captured me just thumbing through the first few pages. Like, ooh, some intrigue here. And there's some thrilling turns in the book. And, of course, you have to build in kind of a cliffhanger to hook folks for the next book, which is due out early next year. What was that like to try to, you know, try to keep folks captivated throughout the book with different twists and turns? And then also, you know, have them stay on board for your next book coming out in January?
Well, it's one thing I try to do when I'm there's two kinds of series. There's this kind of series in which you meet a character, and the character is always the same book by book, always simply on another case. Or in this case, for what I believe will be seven books, I don't think that's the only ones I'll write about Jane, but the first seven books will have an overriding arc. But nevertheless, each one has to stand alone. She has to achieve things at the end of the book, and even though she hasn't reached perfect safety, you have had quite a ride with her, and then that's a fair kind of series book to do in this vein. But I didn't consciously do any cliffhanger. What I felt about these was that if you love these books, you're going to love them largely because of the character. Now, they really move, I think. I wanted to make these books just speed along, and I wanted to have lots of twists and turns in them, which sort of eventuates pretty naturally from the setup. But when I got to the end, I want you to be able to have, of each volume, take a very deep breath and feel, man, she made it. But yet, there's more that's coming. And so that's sort of how I left the first one. She's achieved a lot of what you would want it to see done. But this conspiracy is much more, it's like a hydra. And if you cut off one head, that doesn't mean there isn't another one. And so far, I'm working on book four, and I'm involved in it with the same level of excitement as the first one. So I hope that'll convey to readers. I certainly try my hardest at it.
Yeah, my understanding is that Jane has kind of helped renew you as a writer. Is that accurate?
I would say that's true, yeah. When you've been at it as long as I have, you've tried your hand at a lot of different things, publishers generally don't like that. They like you to do one book of the same kind over and over. And I've moved around to different kind of things. And so I've had my chance at trying almost anything that interested me or I felt was challenging. And when it came to this, you thought, okay, I want to do something with this, a character like this, and do something I haven't seen done before. But still in all, I've written suspense before. So when you're writing it and suddenly you know you've got your hands on something electrifyingly different and something that just excites you, it's a wonderful thing. And it's happened to me before when I've been writing. And that makes, if, especially if it happens in the first 20 or 30 pages of the manuscript and you've got 350 more to go and you're excited off the top of the charts, that is a blessing because the book is going to be hard work. They always are hard work, but it's not going to be that kind of hard work that makes you smash your forehead into the desktop several times a day in frustration. It's going to be hard work that bears fruit every day. And so in that sense, she really has enlivened me and brought me back to the excitement you have when you're doing the early books in your career.
You are listening to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, heard worldwide, 95.9WATD.com. And we're privileged to be speaking with best-selling author Dean Koontz about his newest book, The Silent Corner. Dean, how soon can we see Jane, either on network television or cable? Because from, again, what I'm understanding here is this is a option for television.
It's been optioned by Paramount TV. They actually optioned all the Jane books that there might be. And in association with anonymous content. And anonymous content has, I think, 5 shows on the air recently or still on the air, and they do very classy, stylish stuff, and they seem very excited about it. So, but all of this is a slow process. So these days it does happen a little faster if they get the right showrunner on it. And so I'm very hopeful, but I haven't always had good luck with Hollywood, but given how TV is these days, that it's the place where you see most of what you want to see as compared to feature-length films, which have gotten kind of redundant one after the other, mm-hmm. the same kind of thing. TV is allowing more flexibility in storylines and more cutting-edge kind of stuff. So I'm very hopeful about it, but I've been around the track before, so I don't go to bed hooting with joy that there's going to be a TV series. But I think it's more likely than not going to be good.
Okay. I would ask you, and I would pull this from your frequently asked questions, do you have any movies that are based on your novels, or do you have any that could be in the works?
There's another TV series that seems to be moving forward. It's not filming or anything, but it's based on the novel Ashley Bell that was out about 2 years ago, and a series of novellas I wrote interconnected with the world of the novel, and that was all optioned by Universal, and I know they've been working on that, and there's a couple of things bouncing around in the feature film area, but again, I don't... I always advise young writers when they get, it's so exciting. I got my new book done, and now I'm taking a break from books because I'm writing the screenplay based on it. I always wish them great good luck, but warn them, you can write a script that everybody loves that gets greenlighted, and then after it's greenlighted, which used to mean it would almost certainly be filmed, then you will get some young, very enthusiastic, but megalomaniacal director that will be assigned to it who will some way or other ruin the entire project before it ever gets a chance to go before the camera. And so far, when I've given that warning, there's nobody that hasn't come back and said a couple of years later, boy, I wish I'd have understood what you were telling.
Right.
So I will not be writing any more feature films or TV. I wrote and sold a number of them, but I'm not a guy that can work in a collaborative medium, I guess you would say, and that is all very collaborative. I like to have the total control, and unless you're Steven Spielberg, you don't have total control, and it's too frustrating a medium.
Well, we just got a couple more moments with you, Dean, and I want to kind of stay on the TV thing, because I'm not sure if this is accurate or not, but I believe that you're a fan of the reality show, the TV show Survivor. Is that true?
No, in fact, I've never watched it.
Okay. I thought it was something that I had seen on your website that you were a fan of a series like that.
I'm trying to think what that might have been. What I watch with television is usually series, and I usually binge watch. I wait until it's been on, like Breaking Bad was completely finished before my wife and I started to watch it, mm-hmm. and became so hooked that one Saturday we watched 10 episodes in a row. And that that I liked, and the series that sprang out of that, Better Call Saul, I think is
yep.
one of the finest things on television. So I tend to not watch much TV, and I don't watch a whole lot of reality TV. In fact, I'm not sure I watch any. So that might be something on the website we have to go clear up.
Okay. And probably the final thing I would ask you is tell folks as far as if they want to find out more about things that you're working on, whether it's your website, whether it's your publisher's work website, or maybe social media, how can they follow what Dean Koontz is up to?
Well, one way is the website, which is deankoontz.com, and it's a pretty well-maintained website. It's a lot of content on it, and we put up news as there is any news to put up, and I think my publisher takes care of the Facebook. We have about 1.3 million friends on there. And if we ever get together for a picnic, we're going to need a year to get ready for it, to make all that potato salads.
Well, we want to thank you for coming on, and we know that this is airing prior to your birthday, so we want to wish you an early birthday. Your birthday is coming up on the 9th, correct?
July 9th.
July 9th.
And, I stopped counting them some time ago, but I'm very happy to keep having them.
Well, we wish you a very happy birthday, and we thank you very much for coming and appearing on Monday Night Talk and talking about the book and when the Whisper Room is ready for release. We would love to have you back on to tease folks more about Jane Hawken and what she's up to.
I would be very happy to be there. It's been you draw out your guests very well, so that is a blessing for somebody on this end of the phone.
Well, listen, you have yourself a fantastic day and evening, and we look forward to hopefully talking to you more down the road.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Our guest has been the one and only Dean Koontz, again, a gentleman who has sold, that's a fantastic number, 500 million copies in nearly 40 languages worldwide. A gentleman who has 14 novels that have risen to number one on the New York Times hardcover best-selling list. Titles including One Door Away from Heaven, Dragon Tears, The Husband, Odd Hours, What the Night Knows. Just some great books. And again, he was here to chat with us a little bit about this new book, which is a fantastic book. If you haven't, if you're somebody who loves suspense novels, you definitely want to check this one out. And again, we thank Dean, and we thank his publisher, Penguin Random House, for that fantastic interview, having a chance to speak with a gentleman who, you know, you heard the story as to how he got started. I wanted to make sure I built that in instead of just talking about the book. Had a chance to kind of get a little insight into how he got started in writing books and the deal he cut with Gerda, his wife, who he pays tribute to in the first handful of pages in the book, which is pretty cool. Well, that's going to do it for us here for your July 3rd edition of Monday Night Talk. Have a safe Independence Day, 4th of July. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., where I think we're going to be doing a live remote broadcast. Have yourself a great night.